Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. The baby boomers, the largest generation in American history, are now almost all in their last third of their life, if an average life expectancy is 78. They've spent the previous and early and middle thirds of their lives transforming cultural ideas, expectations, and practices with civil rights, environmental, and women's movements. Will we also transform some of our cultural ideas, expectations, and practices regarding end of life? It's a big question, and my guests today are going to answer a little bit about that, at least in one aspect. I'm joined today by Henry Fersko Weiss, who's an LCSW, or a licensed social worker, who created a very first end-of-life doula program here in the United States with a focus on planning for the last days of lives, conducting vigil, and reprocessing the dying experience with loved ones. Since he created that program in 2003 at a hospice in New York City, he's built and managed many other programs based on his model at hospices in New Jersey. Henry is widely considered a pioneer in the end-of-life industry. Also joining today's discussion is Tracy Virgil, Director of Volunteers for Hospice of San Luis Obispo County and an end-of-life doula. Tracy will be talking about the end-of-life doula services for San Luis Obispo County. This show has been pre-recorded, and we will not have a call-in today. And I want to thank both of you for being here.
My pleasure.
You know, Henry, and it's really nice to have you here from the East Coast. And I understand you're here to do some training with Hospice of San Luis Obispo County volunteers. It would be helpful to know some background about how you got involved in creating the end-of-life doula programs that you did and, you know, what kind of pulled you toward that.
Right. So as a hospice social worker, I was working as a what we call a field social worker, going to visit people in their homes at a large hospice in New York City. And at the time that I was doing that work very actively, I was finding that there were some really what I thought were unfortunate endings that people had to experience, even though they were in a hospice program. Just because of the logistics and the structure of how hospice has to take care of so many patients. And in this hospice that I was at, we had 500 patients on our daily census. So it's large population.
Very.
And as I kept seeing people winding up going to the hospital when they shouldn't, or loved ones missing the last moments of the life of the person who they've been taking care of sometimes for years, it just made me think that there had to be a different way to do this. And at that time, I had a very close friend who was learning to be a birth doula. And I'd never heard that word before.
A doula.
Doula.
Yeah. What is that word?
So it's a Greek word. When I first heard it, I thought it sounded very African. I had all these visions of Africa, but it's a Greek term. And it really means a woman serving another woman. And the women who started doing the birth doula work back in the 70s and 80s adopted that term to talk about what they did, because their work was different from midwives, who were the alternative approach besides doing it in a hospital with nurses and doctors. But doulas don't actually get involved in the physical delivery. Mm-hmm. And so they use that term to kind of distinguish themselves from midwives. And when she told me what it was like, what she was learning, how it was working with women in labor in the early days of her work, every time I heard her talk, I thought, well, this is exactly what we need to do at the end of life. It was so clear to me that their approach would work for people who were dying.
What were you seeing, or what were you feeling that people were missing at the end of life, what you were seeing with patients and their families that you felt like the experiences of doulas could bring into that equation?
So the work that the birth doulas did focused a lot on the emotional component of the experience, you know, helping the woman in labor as well as her partner to really deal with the emotional difficulties and also the momentousness of bringing a life into the world. Mm-hmm. And that's very similar to what we have to face at the end of life. It's a very emotional, obviously a very emotional experience, and people are generally unprepared. And the emotional component of it was being overlooked, I think, a lot because of the focus on the physical care of the person.
Right.
And because death is such a taboo in our society, people don't really face the end of life, think about it or talk about it. And so I think emotionally, spiritually, they tend to be very unprepared. And they're exhausted. And I think the same thing happens through the birth process. You know, at the end of the term of carrying a baby, the woman is often like, I can't wait to get this baby out
right.
of me.
It no longer feels like a joyous event. It's kind of this burden.
Right. Mm-hmm. The process has gotten to the point where the length of it and the obvious difficulties, they just want to see it end.
Right.
Plus the pain, of course. And it's the same at end of life. You know, the caregivers are totally exhausted and spent by the time their loved one is dying. Mm-hmm. You know, they may have been taking care of this person for many months, perhaps many years. Mm-hmm. And so they're emotionally and physically exhausted. And it's hard for them to think about doing it in a different way. And the pain and suffering that they have to see and experience and be present to, I think, is also similar to the birth process. Difficult, different, but similar. So it was that anxiety and fear that I think is common on both ends of the spectrum, as well as the exhaustion, the suffering and pain that are part of the process. We've forgotten that death is a natural process.
We have begun to overlook that, certainly. Yeah.
And so it was those kinds of things that made me think that the way birth doulas approached it, because they honored the momentous nature of what was happening, mm-hmm. they spent time preparing and planning with the woman who was in labor and her partner as to how they were going to do this. What did they want this experience to be about? How did they want it to look and feel? What kind of meaning did they want to bring to this experience? You know, a deeper meaning than just going through the labor as quickly as possible and having a baby at the end.
Now, you actually went through a
birth
doula training.
I did. I took a birth doula training. Actually, I loved the birth doula training I took.
Uh-huh.
And it was in my process of exploring this as a potential way of working at the end of life that I talked to a lot of birth doulas, people who train birth doulas, and then decided that I really should take the training and see what it is exactly that they learn. And I really did try to translate a lot of the techniques and principles and tools that birth doulas use into the end of life. And although there are differences, and certainly over the years that I've been doing this work, our focus has shifted in ways, the basic fundamental principles and approaches are very similar. And so what I did way back in 2003 to start that process and translate it is pretty much the same fundamental approach that we use today.
You've just kind of honed the skills and the training and the teaching that you're doing around that.
Right. And our emphasis is different in certain ways than it is, because there are clear differences in the end-of-life process. So some of our focus has evolved away from some of the early ideas I had about really just translating from birth, the birth process into the...
Because there are some differences.
Yeah.
And what, in the differences, what were you seeing is very, very distinct differences mm-hmm. between the birth and the death doula process?
So I think for the end of life, certainly for the person who is dying, and this is true as well for the family because they're experiencing the death, they're having a death too, there's, I think, a need to look back over one's life and really sum up what my life has been about. I think it's a developmental imperative that we're sort of born with. You know, Eric Erickson talks about the developmental cycles that we go through from birth through adulthood to the end of our lives. And that last phase is what he calls generativity. And it's really about looking at the wisdom that we've acquired and then offering that wisdom back into the world. And that's kind of the role of the of someone when they get older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the elders in our society, that's their role, is to bring that wisdom back into society. So I think when somebody's facing death, no matter what their age, they automatically sort of get pushed into that developmental phase. And so it's very natural to look back over one's life and think, you know, what has this been about?
Mm-hmm. What have I been about?
Yeah. What have I been about? Mm-hmm. What have I learned mm-hmm. in my life? What are the values and beliefs that I've come to hold in my life that I think are important? And what out of that is my inheritance or that I my legacy that I leave to the people who are there past me? The emotional and spiritual legacy, the life learning, what I hope they think about as they live their lives and maybe learn from my example, both from the positive things that have happened in my life as well as the negative things that have happened in my life. So this focus on acquiring a sense of meaning around facing the end of life, I think, is a very important part of the dying process, and it's something that we focus on very intently in the early work we do before the last days of somebody's life. And I think that focus is very different from the, naturally from the birth process.
Right,
That imperative isn't there. So that's an important part that's different, and we've come to focus a lot on that, and we also develop legacies with people, projects that allow them to express the wisdom and meaning that they have come to understand about their lives as they do the work of looking at that.
Sounds overwhelming, especially for someone who's dying, is it?
You know, I think it gives people a sense of purpose in the last days of their life. You know, often when people are dying, they are treated and may even think of themselves as already being done, right? My life's over.
Right.
So even if there's months left, they don't really see what they can do with that time that is productive and meaningful. And so they lack purpose. And I've seen many people, you know, wind up just sort of staring at the TV all the time when
right.
they're lying in bed. And
or sleeping. All the time.
We're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And people tend to pull away from their families and loved ones. They may not want as many visitors. There is a natural, I think, tendency for people to move inward as they approach death. But I think it gets exacerbated by the fact that they don't see any purpose anymore
mm-hmm.
in the time they have left. So this returns a sense of purpose to people and gives them something productive that they can do so that they feel that the quality of the time they have is meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And it also engages them with their friends and families in a very positive way that they may not have had any structure for before.
Right.
So this work of legacy helps to keep people involved. It gives them a more positive sense of the time they have. It helps them to feel in control. And I think people often find it a wonderfully enjoyable thing to look back over their life and figure out, you know, how do I leave this in some concrete way so that the people who are here after me can reconnect? Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't have to be big. I know it does sound like, okay, you know, legacy is a word that sounds heavy.
Right.
But it doesn't have to be big. It can be something simple. You know, it could be collecting recipes, for example.
Right.
And annotating those recipes mm-hmm. with...
Or just leaving your best recipe.
Yeah.
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 Making sure that's written down.
Or... Right. I mean, how many of us think back about, you know, my grandmother's this or my grandmother's that, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Yeah.
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 And so, you know, to just collect those recipes and maybe annotate them in some way, mm-hmm. you know, remembering mm-hmm. a time we ate this particular meal and how wonderful that was, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. why it's the favorite of this person or that person in the family, and maybe including some pictures. And so there's lots of ways of doing it that are fun
right.
and not heavy,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't have to be huge.
Well, and I can see how these kinds of projects, if you will, would offer families and friends an opportunity to engage, to overcome what would seem like very awkward mm-hmm. interactions.
Right.
Because I've frequently heard from friends and others, mm-hmm. I didn't know what to say. You know, what do you say right. to someone who's at the end of their life?
Right.
You know, you're looking good. I mean, what do you,
right.
what do you, how do you interact? What do you tell them? What do you bring them?
Right.
What do you do? So to have some way of engaging just seems mm-hmm. like it would bring a different perspective.
Right. And I think it makes the interactions more substantial, you
mm-hmm.
know. It takes them out of the realm of just being sort of ordinary everyday, because that's what we fall back on. When
right.
we don't know what to say, we fall back on the everyday
yeah.
stuff, like,
yeah.
you know, the football game that happened on Sunday and, you know, did you see that play? Or,
right.
you know, Aunt so-and-so, you know, is having a party next week and talking about that. And it's not that we shouldn't have everyday conversations and about things that don't, you know, aren't deep. But I think if we can also have really deep and substantial interactions, it truly changes the nature of the dying process for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Does it enrich it?
Absolutely. It
yeah.
enriches it, makes it much more meaningful. And there are many different ways of approaching this. It could be an audio, it could be some kind of video that's done, a memory book. It may be letters that are written to children, grandchildren, that they get to open on special occasions over the years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So, which can be incredibly powerful
yeah.
and meaningful in a family to
yeah.
have that.
Yeah. If you just joined us on Central Coast Voices, our topic today is end-of-life doulas and their services and how they're shifting the way we engage with dying in families. My guests are Henry Fersko Wives, who's a social worker who created an end-of-life doula program here in the United States with a focus on planning for the last days of an individual's life. He created that first program in 2003 in hospice in New York City and has managed and built other programs in the East Coast, and has been working with my next guest, Tracy Sturgill, who's the director of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, to bring end-of-life doula program here to San Luis Obispo County. And this show has been pre-recorded, so we're not taking any phone calls today. And Tracy, I'm gonna switch over to you for just a moment here. Why did Hospice of San Luis Obispo County want to become involved in the end-of-life doula services and bringing Henry here?
Mm-hmm. Good. We've had a vigil program at Hospice SLO, or Hospice San Luis Obispo County, since 2008. And that vigil program needed a little bit more of the emotional and spiritual support for clients and what we were able to offer. And the way the program worked was we would get a phone call say, from a social worker at one of the local hospitals, and they had a patient there who was at end of life. We'd get that phone call, and I would call and set up volunteers, vigil volunteers, to go and sit vigil for that patient. But the missing piece was we didn't really know that patient. And so physically we would go and be there so that person would not die alone. Mm-hmm. And we would be there for support for the family. But there was no pre-planning or pre-communication before these volunteers went and sat mm-hmm. with this person at a very, very special time of life. Mm-hmm. It was always an honor to be there. Mm-hmm. And to sit with someone who is transitioning or dying. But there seemed to be a piece missing. Mm-hmm. And so a dialogue was started at Hospice SLO about, we had heard about the doulas, the end-of-life doula programs, and did a little bit of research online and came across Henry's program. And we started a dialogue to see what it was all about and found out through that dialogue that the missing piece that we had in our vigil program would be expanded and met. And so we had dialogue with Henry and arranged for him to come out. And the response from our current volunteers, our vigil volunteers, as well as our in-home volunteers was tremendous. We had 30 heartfelt, open-hearted volunteers come to a training this past weekend and learn from Henry's experience, and it's just a great start.
Now, these are volunteers that have already been trained in hospice work and have been working with individuals
yes.
who are at end of life in different phases.
In different phases, correct. Because we're a volunteer hospice, we have some volunteers that are with clients who still, you know, have years ahead of them, mm-hmm. but we're there to offer that emotional support and that respite support. We also have volunteers who are with patients or clients who are at the end of life mm-hmm. because of maybe cancer or late stage Alzheimer's. So it just seemed like a good fit to melt the two programs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we'll still offer that vigil support for the hospitals if there's a last-minute need to have our volunteers come and sit vigil for a patient. But we want to reach out to the community, San Luis Obispo County-wide, and meet the needs, the emotional needs that Henry addressed for these families and these clients that are facing end of life.
And Henry, you're in the design of the doula program, it's much more comprehensive. I mean, vigiling for with families and clients is a component mm-hmm. of it. And you talk about helping to extend more time with the family and providing emotional support and preparation for
yeah.
the death. Can you talk a little bit about how that works within the end-of-life doula program?
Sure. So one of the things that we do in addition to this meaning work and legacy work is we really plan for what the last days are going to be like. And we help people to think through how do they want that to unfold. And this does come directly out of what the work birth doulas do, because planning is an important part of that as well. What we want to do is to help people to take a look at how should this space in which the dying is happening feel? How should it look? What kinds of music might be really helpful to somebody? What kind of reading or spiritual involvement? Do they want prayer? How do they want that time to really happen in a way that gives deeper meaning to the experience and also makes it more comfortable for not only the person who's dying but the family as well, because it's their death too. And mm-hmm. so one of the things we talked about during the training is how often the space around somebody who's dying is filled with very medical-looking equipment.
Clutter.
And supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the space is almost hospital-like, even if it's in a home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really not conducive to experiencing it in a deeper emotional and spiritual way. Mm-hmm. So we talk about, you know, really clearing the space, mm-hmm. cleaning the space, making it beautiful, mm-hmm. and so that it honors the life that is ending. We really want to show our respect and honor the dignity of the person, even at a point where they may not be responsive any longer to the outside. And we know that hearing is the last of the senses to go. And even beyond that, I think people are kind of aware of what's happening around them, even when they seem unresponsive to us. So to have a room that has, you know, soft light, flowers, you know, around the room, perhaps candles burning in the evening or even during the day, the kind of music that this person loved being played frequently around them, things that matter to them being read to them, that they are engaged with in a way that they have talked about and feel would be right for them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of planning that goes into designing how this last few days of life will be. And that's part of the pre-vigil work that we do. And then when the vigil time comes, the doulas are taking the role of maintaining that space, holding that space in a way that the family and hopefully the person who's dying have talked about.
So they're really taking the responsibility for taking that work on so that the family doesn't have to worry about it.
Right.
Or maintain it. Because I as you were talking about doing all of that, I'm thinking of, for instance, a joyous event like a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people that have ever tried to get married and be the planner and do all of that for their own wedding,
mm-hmm.
it's impossible.
Yeah.
It's because you can't be present mm-hmm. for an event and hold the space for making sure that the flowers are there or the guests are there or people are seated or, so I can imagine that for families that are in an emotional state at mm-hmm. the end of someone's life and want to be with that person, to have someone like a doula that you're talking about to just take care of that would be an amazing gift.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's one of the things that's so important for the vigils that the doulas are involved with, because they take away the burden of having to worry about making sure that these things are occurring.
Yeah.
And it gives the family an opportunity to really focus on being loving and available and heartfelt with the person and not having to worry about all those other things that make the atmosphere and the environment so beautiful and meaningful for.
So is this just one doula that is doing this? How does that work? I would think, for instance, if it's the end of a person's life, people don't die like they do on television, right?
Right.
Where they say one sweet sentence and then they're quiet and they're gone. So we could be talking days.
Yes.
So how does that work with the doula?
So the doulas work in shifts. So the planning work we had talked about earlier, the planning and also the work around meaning and legacy, is work that one doula can do. And we call that person the lead doula,
mm-hmm.
who has the general responsibility for managing this particular case. But when it comes to the vigil, then people work in shifts. And we try to be there around the clock as much as possible. We often can be there around the clock. And so the doulas come in shifts, and they work that way throughout the entire vigil.
So the person is never without a doula present
right.
for support during their last days.
Right. The person as well as the family, the goal mm-hmm. of the doulas is to support the patient or the client as much as possible, but also the family. And there's a lot of emotional and spiritual support that's very helpful to
mm-hmm.
family.
Mm-hmm.
And we use guided visualization.
Talk about how that's used.
So guided visualization is a very powerful tool for helping people just to feel generally more relaxed or calm or in a deeper kind of spiritual place. It's also something that helps people with symptom management.
Like pain or fear or anxiety.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Nausea is which is another common symptom that people deal with. But particularly, I think, pain and for the person who's dying, pain and restlessness or agitation are two very important symptoms for us to try and work with. And those symptoms are often medically handled. There's medications that people get to help ease those particular symptoms. But there are alternative techniques that are also very useful and give people a sense of control over the situation that they don't have just when they're getting medication. And so visualization is one of those techniques. And what we do is, for example, we might ask somebody to tell us in a lot of detail about a place they love in nature, either a place they know and have gone to frequently in their life, or a place they went to once and just thought was amazing, or even something that they've seen in a magazine. Or
they'd like to be.
Yeah, they'd like to go. And then we will describe that to them with all of the senses so that we bring them to that place in their imagination. And the really interesting thing about the imagination, and this has been studied and there's a lot of research on this, is that when we go someplace in our imagination like that, take a trip, so to speak, we are almost like we're there. So we have the same emotional response, the same internal response to that place as if we were actually in that place. And so that gives us an opportunity to connect people to something that they think of as being beautiful and peaceful, and may even give them a sense of being part of something larger than just themselves.
So it's a way of connecting the family with the person who's dying, if they're both doing the visualization together.
And I think it's certainly effective, and I've seen it many times. Patients who are somewhat agitated or restless, and you can see it in their bodies, even though they can't tell you that they're experiencing this, we can see it. And when we do visualization, they calm down, and you can see the impact on their bodies physically. I think it certainly has impact on someone who's in their, even in the last stages of their dying, right up to the end. I think it can be effective. And I think it's also very helpful for family to help them with their anxiety and their fear, and just to calm them and help them to relax, and also to connect to the deeper meaning of what's happening.
Yeah. Now, I would think, too, that having doulas present during the active dying process would also give some comfort to the family, because I'm assuming these doulas are trained in end of life. They're trained in the different signs and symptoms as patients progress through the dying process, so that they could explain that.
Yeah.
Make it less frightening, maybe.
Right. Their role is really to support everybody who's involved in this process emotionally, spiritually, and through information as well. One of the things that the doulas will often do is, you know, tell me about this person who's lying here. You know, this person has a rich history, and there have been, you know, countless numbers of things that you've done together, places you've gone, things that were said. So tell me about this person. Tell me some stories. What are some of your favorite stories? And that really helps bring people back into really engaging with the whole span of somebody's life, not just
what's happening right now.
Yeah. And as the signs and symptoms of the dying process change, as they do as someone declines in those last days, the doulas are there to help people understand what's normal, what's natural, what they will see and hear, what's going to come next, and to help them to really understand that process in a way so that they're not as distressed by some of the things that people do struggle with because they don't understand that this is a natural part of the dying process.
Right. Do in your programs, are the end-of-life doulas used in conjunction with medical hospice at home? Or do they provide services, say, if the patient is in the hospital mm-hmm. or in a long-term care facility or even an emergency room where the environment's very different than being able to have candles and their own mm-hmm. things around them?
Yeah. So we do. We have mm-hmm. Done vigil work and the doula work in all those kinds of settings. In the hospital, in nursing homes, assisted livings. And there are challenges of those environments that
sure.
you don't face at home. And it doesn't have as much of the rich comfort that you can have at home when you have your own things around you.
Sure.
But we try to, if we know a death is going to occur in that kind of environment, then we talk about, okay, how do we make this space as comforting and as home-like as we can? What can we bring mm-hmm. into this space to give it some of those qualities so that it isn't as sterile or as empty of the person's own personality and, you know, their life history?
And the doulas really are trying to do that so that the family doesn't have to try and
right.
think or be overwhelmed with the medicinalness of or the sterility of the environment.
Yeah, and the doulas can do a lot of the legwork, you
yeah.
know, that needs to occur, even with deaths at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're talking about certain music this person loved and
mm-hmm.
making sure that that music is there in the space and available, if there were particular things that they thought would be helpful to have read, or if there are objects that they want around them, or if they're going to collect stories from friends and relatives, all of that legwork the doula can take on
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
so that the family can still keep focused on being really present in a loving way to the person and not worrying about all those details.
Yeah. What a wonderful, it really does sound like a wonderful program. And you've been doing this since 2003 and
yes.
On the East Coast.
Yes.
Are there models like this in Europe or other countries where this just kind of is part of the ongoing model?
You know, I'm not as familiar with what kinds of doula work might be occurring in other countries, but we've been getting a lot of calls from people in other places wanting us to bring the program there. I've had people call me from Singapore.
Really?
And, yeah, I'm from Israel and from Austria. There's been a lot of interest internationally in this model, and I've done... For the last few years, I've been teaching up in Canada as well, and Canada has a very different system of
right.
hospice, and they don't typically have home hospice.
No.
It's all facility-based.
Hospice is facility-based, right.
And so it's a very different approach, and I am now working with an organization in Canada that's trying to change that and bring home hospice and make it that way the system works. So it's called the Home Hospice Association in
wow.
Canada, and I've been doing a lot of work with them to try and make this happen in Canada and change the system.
That's great. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas to Paso Robles, 95.1 Lompoc, 90.9 Santa Ynez, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at kcbx.org. I'm joined today by Henry Fersco Wives, social worker who created the very first end-of-life doula program in the United States. We're talking about end-of-life doulas and how they play a fascinating and astounding role in end-of-life experience for both the patients and the families, and how that's really starting to move outward. And also with me is Tracy Sturgill, Director for volunteers at Hospice of San Luis Obispo County and an end-of-life doula. And Tracy, I want to go back to you here. And so you have now these trained doulas. Is this going to be a service that is going to be made available to people in their own homes, in facilities? I mean, how are you envisioning this is working in San Luis Obispo County?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be in available for homes, but also we want to bring the services to patients that are on services with the medical hospices in the area, mm-hmm. as well as assisted living. We want to make sure that the community is aware that the service is available. So that is our main goal, to get that service out there. And also, you mentioned before, too, the phobia of death and how that discussion is not occurring. This doula program, this end-of-life doula program, will help us to alleviate maybe some of that fear of even talking about it. And as Henry mentioned, the pre-planning, the dialogue about meaning of mm-hmm. a person's life, mm-hmm. The legacy that he talked about, the projects that we talk about. I think as the doulas go into these homes or these settings, they will assist to alleviate some of that fear and maybe eliminate some of these, as Henry mentioned, unfortunate deaths. But first, we will need to educate the county and let them know that we are available.
So is there a cost for these services? Mm-hmm. I mean, these doulas are volunteers, correct?
These doulas are volunteers through Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, or Hospice SLO, and all of our services are free, no matter where they're at. So if a patient is on one of the medically certified hospices, we'll just be an added service for that patient.
So it just helps to further support the patient.
Yes, because a lot of times even though they have a team coming into the home, those patients sometimes have blocks of times, hours that, you know, they can't.
They're just with the family.
Right, yeah, mm-hmm. and that family needs that support.
And Henry, have you ever had a patient die alone when you've had them on end-of-life doula service?
No, in all
Never.
These years, not once since 2003.
That's pretty amazing.
Have we had a patient die alone? And I know that we have educated. I teach this publicly, too, in a holistic learning center in New York City and also in Canada and Toronto. I'm going out to Calgary soon. I know that this program and this approach has been used by many people now, even without the formal kind of structure of the
right.
doula program that I'm bringing to Hospice of San Luis Obispo. But I suspect that it's made a real difference in many people's dying process and avoided some of those unfortunate deaths and I hear about it sometimes from people that I've talked to who call me up and say, you know, we're going through this now. Can you just tell us what we need to do? How can we make this as meaningful as possible? And then I'll talk with them afterwards. And so I know it makes a difference, and I know that even in those situations, people don't end up dying alone because there's a different orientation to this process.
Can you give me an example of maybe a difference that you see between what you were experiencing or what you're describing as an unfortunate death before you were able to bring this kind of a surface to your patients?
Yeah, so I often go back to thinking about this one client that I had when I was a social worker in New York City who was being taken care of by, he was about 86, and I think his caregiver was his sister, who was about 88. Mm-hmm. She was older than he was, and she got panicked into calling 911, and he was taken off to an emergency room in a hospital that he had never been in and knew nothing about him. And he ended up dying there after hours and hours of being in the emergency room, which is a very chaotic experience, not conducive to a gentle ending of one's life. and even had been pushed out into the hallway for some number of hours in the early morning, just totally unattended and uncared for and not having the one person in the world who meant something to him at his bedside, and then was put in a room with somebody who was really suffering and was very loud and in a lot of pain. And it's those sounds that he was hearing as he took his last breaths without his sister being present.
Mm-hmm.
And she found him the next morning. That she was the one who discovered that he had died. Not even the staff knew, because they really stopped paying attention to him once he was at the. So that death really stayed with me, and I struggled a great deal with how tragic his ending was for him, for his sister as well. And I think that's one of the ones that was an important motivation for me to really try and find a way to make this different.
And when we look at how many people are actually still dying, even though even in hospice services now, we're finding that people are getting onto hospice much later.
Absolutely.
Often 3 days, last 3 or 4 days of their lives. So the ability for them to communicate about their wishes, if that's the only time that they've really, as a family unit, even thought about death as the ultimate ending.
Right.
It's not conducive to what you're talking about.
So. No. If you don't have time to really do the work that's important and to spend time looking over one's life, engaging with your family in ways that are deeply meaningful, the only focus you can have is on the absolute, physical. Did they get their medication at this time? Did they not get their medication at this time?
Right.
And, how do we just maybe shift them in bed so they're a little more comfortable? And that becomes the entire focus. And when you don't have much time, it's more like crisis.
Right.
It's crisis for everybody, for the patient dying, for the family. And so you're not thinking, you're not really experiencing it in a deeper way. And
does it make it really awkward and depressing for the family to have you come in and talk with the family about what this person's legacy would be? I mean, does it, because I would think families would want to avoid that kind of discussion if what's in the air is, gee, we want to hope this person is not going to die.
Yeah.
And with a phobia about dying, it would seem like that's kind of where we keep ending up.
Well, I think that's the initial response that people have before we get started.
Okay.
That
what shifts?
I think what shifts is when we explain to them what the purpose of this is, and we talk about the experience that we have had with other families and patients and how it has changed, really transformed that experience for them, they start to open up. And once they start doing the work, for a lot of them, it becomes something that's joyous. They get a lot of fun out of collecting the stories from friends and relatives and saying, oh, look at this one. Look what, Uncle Sam had to say. And this is a story we didn't even know about. So there's a lot more sort of life in the process of dying. And I think we forget that people are still living as they're dying.
And that's really an important point. But there's this fear, I think, that is kind of that elephant in the room, that if you start to talk about dying, it accelerates it. Have you found that to be true? That when the discussion comes around to a legacy or talking with somebody about the imminent end of their life, that they give up and they just go ahead and die faster?
So, this is something that hospices have always faced. And I think that's one of the reasons that hospice, the length of stay in hospice that
is getting
shorter
yeah.
is because people have this sense that, as soon as my loved one goes on hospice, they're just going to die.
Check out.
Right.
Yeah.
And the research says the opposite.
Really?
When they have looked at the length of life for people who are roughly the same point in their illness and compared it between people who went on hospice and people who didn't, the people who went on hospice live longer.
Really?
Yeah. It's. I think it's about 30 days longer was the average length of life between being on hospice and not being on hospice.
Is it because they're more comfortable and more engaged?
Yeah. It's because they're more comfortable, they're better taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because they start to understand that I'm still living.
Yeah. I get that.
Yeah. And so I have things I can still do. Mm-hmm. I can still make this time.
Like create your legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people enjoy this process.
Uh-huh.
I've had many people who, you know, tell me how wonderful, you know, they were hesitant and they didn't know how this was going to be. And talking about all of this openly is makes them feel anxious to start with. But when they get involved.
Can you give me an example or two of legacy projects that ended up at the end of the day with you?
So I was just thinking about this one woman that we were working with probably about 4 or 5 months ago. And so we had decided we were going to do a memory book. And it was her husband had taken photographs of everything. He was one of those people. And he put it in books and it was organized. When I went into her bedroom, there was a shelf that I was shown that had albums all lined up across the shelf with dates on the binding. And so we talked about doing a memory book. But because there was so much stuff, we wanted to focus it on what she considered to be the most important parts of her life. And when we started the work, I'll never forget the day I came to actually start to put things together. We were working in the dining room, and the dining room table was covered with all kinds of artifacts of her life. She even had her 8th grade graduation diploma, and which she was very proud of, and it was just such a joyous occasion to put together, pull out, and take a look at all of these amazing things that she had collected and held on to. Letters from her husband from the first time they met, and he had gone over to – he was in Europe during the war, World War II, and wrote to her, and every letter was collected, and they had – so we were able to take parts of, you know, really important parts of those letters and mm-hmm. put that into the memory book. And everybody had so much fun and connected to each other in a way that they had not been because they were so focused on just, oh, she's dying and what we have to do.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah, you before we came on the air, you had mentioned something about sea glass, too.
Yeah.
What was that?
So that was with someone who had collected sea glass her whole life. And she decided that she wanted to use the sea glass as part of her legacy because it was something she always loved. And everybody in the family knew how important – everybody, if they went to the beach, would find sea glass and bring it to her. So she sort of identified what she felt were some really important things to live by, things that she had tried to live her life
kind
by.
Kind of values.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and how she hoped other people, particularly children in the family, would hold on to those values and find them in their own life. And so we literally expressed those values in words built out of the sea glass. And then we placed them between two clear panes of glass so you could see it either way and the light would flow through on either side. And then framed it in wood that some members of the family had collected from favored places that she would go and that they would spend time in the woods.
You know, I have read many, many pieces that talk about how people want to feel as though they've made a difference or been a difference. And part of people's feeling toward the end of life is that they haven't or fearing they have not done what they wanted to do or had the impact that they wanted to have. I would think that something like this with a family, even on a small scale, is a way of saying, yeah, you did have an impact.
Absolutely.
And you will after you're no longer here.
Yeah. And to hear it back, you know, there was one woman whose family made a memory book, and they collected these stories. And several weeks before she died, she was still mentally alert. The project had been finished, and they had this family dinner. It was actually a Passover dinner,
mm-hmm.
and the family had collected, and they read the book to her.
Oh, how nice.
And so she got to sit there and hear all the stories that people loved, the things that they loved about her, the way they had been impacted by her.
Right.
And, you know, we don't often get to feel how important our life has been
to
those around us. And to hear it back, you know, read back to you, it was an amazing experience and I think really important for her.
Yeah. Yeah. You were going to say something?
Yeah, I was. Henry, during the training, had brought up and you had mentioned also that some families might feel a little overwhelmed when they hear the word legacy and,
sure.
and think it has the artifacts from years back, and maybe they don't have those. So he mentioned having a basket by the bedside with, like I pictured hearts, shapes of hearts and papers shaped in hearts. And visitors could write memories or how that person had an impact mm-hmm. on their lives and then leave that either in the basket or around the room. And then those also could be read to the patient, and I thought that was huge because that's not this huge, huge project, and it's something that would still show the love mm-hmm. and that they're still living.
Yeah. So if someone wanted to talk more about the end-of-life doula program, Tacy, how would they get a hold of you?
They could either call me at the Hospice Slo County office, which mm-hmm. is 544-2266. Or email me, and my email's on our website, hospiceslo.org.
Okay.
And I would love to, we're going to be offering another training in January or February of 2016.
And Henry's going to be coming
back
for that.
Yeah, Henry's coming back for that. So we would love to have people join us.
Okay.
Yeah, I really look forward to that. And, you know, we didn't talk about another part of the program, is I just want to briefly point out that our work doesn't mm-hmm. stop when the person dies. You know, we come back and we work with them afterwards. We work with family afterwards. And that's another important part of our program.
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to get that in before we ended today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought it back to that. And I hope when you come back in January, we can talk some more.
That'd be great.
Yeah. I want to thank my guests today. Henry Fersko Weiss, who's the founder of the End of Life Doula Program here in the United States, a focus on planning for the last days of a person's life by focusing on a lot more with planning with the family and other loved ones, both before, during, and after a person's end of life, and Tracy Sturgill, Director of Volunteers for Hospice of San Luis Obispo County and End of Life Doula. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. Your suggestions for future show topics are always welcome. Please send them to voices@kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices. Today's show was pre-recorded. Thank you.